legal and economic challenges to the plan? How has the financial industry fought back? And are other cities with high foreclosure rates ready to follow suit? Join the conversation and call in with your questions on the Next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
And that's tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. right here on KLW. And, of course, tonight at 11 o'clock, it's a rebroadcast of this morning's Your Call on that program that we will re-listen to this evening. What do the changes in Israeli society and politics mean for the future of the peace process and Israel's role in an unstable Middle East? That's a rebroadcast of this morning's Your Call tonight at 10 o'clock. Right now it's 7 o'clock, and that means it's time for City Visions. This is KLW San Francisco.
Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, David Onick. Our topic this hour: is the internet promoting scientific debate or stifling it? A few weeks ago, Popular Science magazine announced that it was no longer allowing commenting at the end of its online articles. Its editors cited an inability to monitor the comments for misinformation and tone, as well as their fear that comments could compromise the science being reported on. This comes at a time when some scientists are pushing for more commenting opportunities at the end of scientific papers published online. These two divergent efforts, removing commenting versus adding commenting, reflect a larger effort in the scientific community to evaluate and publish scientific studies in a way that adjusts to the strengths and weaknesses of the internet age. Can scientific standards be maintained in an online world? Why is it that the editors of Popular Science and scientists at Stanford appear to disagree about the use of the internet in science publishing? Joining me in studio to discuss these issues are Jonathan Dugan, director of PLOS Labs, an open-source science publisher. Throughout his career, Jonathan has focused on the promotion of science education and open culture. Prior to joining PLOS, he was a consultant working primarily with nonprofits focused on these topics. In 2005, he founded and led the startup Clearbits, providing services to host and distribute open licensed digital media. He previously served as platform evangelist at BitTorrent and as business development director at SRI International. He was co-founder of BioE2E, the San Francisco Bay Area nonprofit community for teaching entrepreneurship and startup techniques to biotech professionals. Jonathan received his PhD from Stanford University in biomedical informatics. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Robert Tibshirani, is a professor of statistics and health research and policy at Stanford University. Robert's main interests are in applied statistics, biostatistics, and data mining. He is co-author of the books Generalized Additive Models, An Introduction to the Bootstrap, and Elements of Statistical Learning. His current research focuses on problems in biology and genomics, medicine, and industry. With colleagues, he also develops software packages for genomics. Welcome, Robert.
Thanks.
And we're joined by Peter Aldous, a freelance journalist and the former San Francisco bureau chief of New Scientist magazine. His interests range across biology, medicine, social sciences, and environment. He also teaches in the science writing program at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Peter previously worked as a reporter for Nature magazine and Science magazine. His articles have won awards from the Association of British Science Writers, the Association of Healthcare Journalists, and Society for Environmental Journalists. Welcome, Peter.
Thanks.
And welcome as well to you, our listeners. Later in the program, you will have a chance to call or email us and join the conversation. Well, let's start with a Popular Science magazine ban on online comments. The magazine, which has been around for 141 years, said it was making this decision because a vocal minority of, quote, shrill, boorish specimens of the lower internet phyla, end quote, and added that comments can be bad for science. Peter, what is your take on Popular Science's decision to remove comments?
I actually think we want to view this not so much in the context of science, but in the context of journalism and media more widely. Popular Science, it's a popular magazine. It is not publishing primary research. Now, I've spent most of my career working for the same type of publications. I'm still doing so, now working for Medium and Matter, two predominantly online publications. Now, the issues that those publications face are on a fairly small number of topics where this type of troll warring in the comments happens. And they're topics like evolution, climate change, to a certain extent, anything around reproductive health, embryo research, for example. Topics that are politically and culturally controversial. And what happens then is you do get people who, with strong opinions and loud voices on both sides of the debate, screaming at each other, almost, in comment sections. It isn't very edifying. On most scientific topics, physics, other areas of environmental science, you don't see it to the same extent. So I think the issues are very similar to those faced by the New York Times, by Gawker, for instance, which have taken very different approaches to comments, which I can talk a little bit about. And my own my own take is that popular science is being a little bit defeatist and is actually letting the trolls win and letting the trolls silence more reasonable voices by just turning it all off. Now, if you want a debate around articles, be they about science or anything else, you've got to treat that as part of your editorial product. You've got to moderate it in some way. That's what popular science said it didn't have the resources to do. That's their decision. You know, it's a respectable decision. I would take a different view and look at what some other organizations are doing. So if we look at the New York Times, for instance, they moderate all the comments on their articles initially. But you can become a verified commenter, and then your comments go straight to the website. How does that happen? There's an algorithm that works out what the editors have done with your previous comments. The editors don't manually make you a verified commenter, but when you've got a sufficiently good reputation, you can go unmoderated and comment on the articles. And that process together helps get a more reasonable debate. Not less, you know, still robust views, but a more reasonable debate. Gawker's an interesting one. You know, this is a product of the internet. What do? They get their other commenters to vote comments up and down. So the people who are participating in the discussion can decide who they think is interesting and who they collectively and who they want to listen to. Now, you know, Gawker isn't the New York Times. It's a different beast. It's a little bit more of a rough and tumble world, perhaps. But again, their comment section is an interesting place, I think.
But didn't Paul Krugman in the New York Times in a recent article say, I am not allowing any comments on this article. It was about 9/11 because I fear what will happen. And I guess he had the right to do that.
There may be cases where you want to do that. I'd say particularly where there are going to be legal issues, you may want to take a very tight control of comments. But in general, you know, I believe in open debate. I think most of the people around this table and listening to this show will believe in open debate. So I would argue better to find ways, and really, particularly in the Bay Area, it should be within our sort of collective social and technical wit to do that, to foster a more reasonable debate in which the trolls don't dominate.
Robert, what's your take?
Well, I agree. I mean, and one of the reasons I'm here is I helped to spearhead the PubMed Commons commenting system and to encourage and facilitate comments and for scientific papers.
Why don't you talk a little bit about PubMed? And that's in beta testing now, correct? The commenting part. So why don't you talk about the motivation behind it and how it's coming along?
Right. So I'm a statistician and scientist at Stanford. And like a lot of scientists, I'll read a paper in a journal and I'll find something that maybe I think there's a flaw, a small or large flaw in the paper. And what happens in the current system is you write to the authors, and the authors, they might be somewhat helpful, but they typically will tell you a little more detail, but they won't go out of their way to help you find a potential flaw in their paper, obviously. The incentive is not there. So what happens then, you write a letter to the editor of a journal. The letters are refereed. They're not, again, you might get it published, but when it finally is published, your letter, it's cut down to 400 words. So you really can't say what you want to say. The whole system is not set up to encourage commentary on papers. So I, like others, have the idea, well, why can't we have a system like on Amazon when you want to buy a camera? You go to Amazon, you look to see, what have people said about this camera, good and bad? Why not the same system for scientific papers? what do people, scientists in general, think about this paper? Do they have other views? Do they find problems? So I had the idea of having a website, just a standalone website for scientific commentary. I spoke to Pat Brown, who's actually one of the founders of PLOS, where Jonathan works. Pat said, well, that's a good idea, except you have to build it in a place where people go. Right? If you have a standalone website, you're not going to get enough traffic. So he introduced me to David Lippman, who runs PubMed.
So right? Tell us what PubMed is. Why were people already going there?
Well, PubMed is a central resource. It's a website for biomedical papers in the U.S. and the world. And it gets something like 3 million hits a day from people. So that's where people go to read papers in medicine and biology. So Pat had the very good insight. If you can build it there, people will come. So he introduced me to David Lippman, and David works he runs the NCBI and runs PubMed. And David said, yes, we've had that idea for a long time, but we haven't been able to convince the leadership of NIH to do it because they tend to be conservative, right? They don't want people criticizing work on their own by their own scientists. But if the community can show support for this, maybe that together we can get this done. So I rallied people. I formed actually teams of people in different areas like oncology, cardiology. And those teams, basically, it was just a website of people who supported the idea, and they became the first beta test site for a group for PubMed. And we as the system got built, they tested it out. It also showed the NIH that there's a lot of people in the community that really want this idea. And just now last week, so David's group has built it and tested it, and then last week it's opened up to a larger group. We have about 75,000 people who have sort of pre-approved to use the system.
And what kind of pushback have you gotten so far?
Pushback? Well, there's been, a small percentage of people who are worried that you know, you'll be able to trash someone's reputation by criticizing their paper. One thing we had to really think carefully about was should we force the comments? Should they be anonymous or non-anonymous? That was a difficult decision.
That's a big decision, absolutely.
Yes. And we wanted to start with high. We wanted the comments to be of high quality. It's hard to go from a system that's low quality and move it to high quality. You've got to start high quality. So we decided to finally, with a lot at stake in scientific papers, we wanted people to identify who they are. So we've really been strict about that. You have to identify yourself, and hopefully then the quality of the conversation will be high.
And Peter, what about you? What was your reaction when you heard about what happened at Popular Science? Let's go to Jonathan. I'm sorry.
My reaction was very similar to Peter's. I think that we need more commenting. I think we need more discussion. It really aligns with some of the mission of PLOS around open access and actually in line with a desire to have more commenting. I actually was approached by Rob to help him pull together some people to test out the PubMed Common system.
So tell us a little bit about PLOS. So we're going to end up with a conversation about all these things, but I really want to understand what is open access publishing? Because really what you're talking about is very different than Popular Science. As Peter said, that's really a journalism, whereas what you're talking about are scientific papers.
Right. So open access publishing is essentially a movement of a variety of science publishers. So these are publishers that are actually publishing science articles. PLOS, the Public Library of Science, located here in San Francisco, is one of the leaders in this movement. We've been around for about 10 years. The main difference that defines open access is the license terms and the business model of how the papers get published. So previously, traditional publishers would take the copyright for papers when they were published by a scientist and then bundle those papers together into journals and then sell access to the journals back to libraries and individuals. And that model we typically call traditional publishing, traditional science publishing, and it still represents on the order of 80 to 85% of all the papers that are published in science. Under open access publishing, the researcher pays up front an article processing charge once. And then once the paper is published, it's freely and open rights available to the world. We use a license called Creative Commons, specifically the CC BY license, which means that anyone who wants to do anything with these papers, they want to use them in their classroom, they want to bundle them up in a book and distribute it, or just print it out and keep copies for themselves, they have the right to do that immediately from the time that it gets published.
So one thing that I think drives seems a little strange to some people is that the authors are actually paying to have their work published. So can you respond to that criticism from the layperson about this method?
Sure. Well, the process of publishing ends up taking a lot of work. There is technical checks, making sure the people are who they say they are. It's going through making sure the university is who they say they are, that it isn't just a scam or someone trying to get a paper published for their own personal gain. There then, if done right, the process of getting a paper published also includes a bunch of ethics checks to make sure that the animals were treated correctly, etc. It requires people to check the article in several ways. And then, once that happens, the publisher goes out and finds an editor and peer reviewers. And for some journals, some top-tier journals, those editors are paid staff. And for other journals run by a community, those editors are typically scientific researchers working in the field who volunteer their time to shepherd the paper through the review process. Then, on top of that, you have to go find other scientists who are experts in that field who are willing to read the work, create a traditional peer review, which is a sort of a block of text. Usually that takes several weeks. And then once it gets all the way through that process, the reviews have happened. Usually there can be cycles. They have to go back. They have to edit. They have to recheck things. They have to change things, maybe do more experiments. And then in sort of before the last 6 to 10 years or so, it was then published in a paper journal. But now almost all the new journals are all coming out digitally. But there's still typesetting. There's still formatting, hosting, serving. So there's work that needs to be done. And the two different models, the traditional publishing versus the open access model, both have revenue to cover that work that's being done. The proponents of open access, and I'm one of them, would argue that if we pay for that work once, up front, when it's done, and then allow the science to be freely and openly available to the world...
From then on.
Forever, essentially, yes. That better aligns with what science is about. I mean, that really is the premise that we have with science, where taxpayers are funding us to do research and then share that knowledge with the world. It's actually far less expensive to pay for it once than it is to give the copyright to a private company, usually a for-profit company, and then have them sell access almost in perpetuity. I mean, the copyright term is incredibly long. But if you look at the amount of money that's actually being spent on the traditional publishing, it's significantly more than it would be if we actually paid just once when we did the publishing work.
Peter?
And if I can speak as a consumer of the primary scientific literature, as a consumer of those papers, I'm a science journalist. I download papers, read them, and write about them every day. It's what I do. And open access, you're not going to hear a word against it from people like me. It clearly makes sense. I don't have to pay for access to the material that I need to do my job.
And through your taxes, you actually already paid for the research and the publishing. So why would you have to pay again a private company who just is holding the copyright?
Well, that's an interesting twist on this, is how much of this research is funded by the federal government. And so people are saying, hey, our tax dollars are already going to this. How strong an argument is that in this whole debate?
It's quite strong. In fact, it's part of the advocacy work that PLOS does, is to talk to both government funders and private funders to help steer the grant-making process toward open access. And in some parts of the world, it's not quite as far along in America, but certainly in other parts of the world, England in particular, for example, publishing open access is part of many of the funding streams that scientists have available to them.
And, you know, Peter, you said how important it was for you to be able to read these articles. What about scientists in developing countries whose universities might not be able to afford the huge amounts that some of these journals cost? Can someone please speak to the opportunities that have opened up there?
I can speak to that. PLOS actually runs a international program in a variety of ways. And one of our missions is to get more scientific papers out into the developing world. It's a very complex issue because most of science and science publishing, science funding, is first world. It's focused on United States, England, and the first world. So not only is there just the literal, it costs this to access the papers, which many publishers do have programs, PLOS included, that have lower fees or lower access fees for developing countries. The more complex issue is that without easy access, people in the developing world are sort of excluded from the science process. They're not asked to be reviewers. They're not you know, they don't have available grants to them, and it's actually just a classing system of who's in science and which kinds of science questions get funded and investigated. And by making the access easier at the end, even though cost may not be the primary issue, making it open access to them helps level that playing field as well.
Peter?
Yeah, having spoken up in favor of open access, I think it's probably also fair to add in a note of concern that I know PLOS, among other publishers, are very worried, concerned about addressing. And this is, there is an inherent conflict in this new model which could be exploited and possibly is by certain less scrupulous publishers. And this is basically, if as the publisher you're getting paid publication fees, then there's a little bit of a conflict there potentially with the idea that we're going to have peer review and scrutinize articles and perform all of the checks, the necessary checks that Jonathan talked about. You know, is there going to be the temptation to scrimp on that or even just not to do it to rake in the money? And there has been some discussion of this. I'm sure the other two guests will have things to say about it, but I think it has to be something we have in mind as we, I think, will increasingly move towards an open access model for how science is published.
Let's take a quick station break and then we'll follow up on that very point. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at kalw.org. Tonight, we're discussing whether the internet is promoting scientific debate or stifling it. With our guests, Jonathan Dugan, director of PLOS Labs, an open source science publisher, Robert Tibshirani, professor of statistics and health research and policy at Stanford University, and Peter Aldous, former San Francisco bureau chief of New Scientist magazine and now a freelance journalist. Let's follow up on that point that Peter just made. Jonathan, what's your response?
Sure. Just a quick correction. Actually, PLOS is an open access publisher, not an open source publisher. We do have some tools that are open source, and we're good friends with the open source folks. But
I appreciate that correction. Yeah.
Peter brings up a good point. We do know that there are some unscrupulous actors in the publishing industry, but it's not necessarily limited to open access publishers. There's unscrupulous actors in every industry. And some of the incentives shift when you're paid up front, and some of the incentives stay the same when you're focused on publishing and making high-quality journals. Because at the end of the day, scientists are in a unique position where they have to publish, which means they have to go to some publisher primarily if they want to go through the peer review process. And they have a choice of which journal they publish in and which publisher they go to. And that choice is based primarily on the prestige of that journal. There's some factors that people use to measure them, like impact factor. But typically, they want to get published in the place that has the most impact and the most prestige. Unscrupulous actors in any marketplace aren't going to have that kind of prestige. And so, yes, that issue exists. There are some unscrupulous actors who do publish open access journals. The bar is lower because you're getting paid up front. But there's also incredibly unscrupulous behavior by lots of other publishers as well. We don't need to dig down into there. That's not necessarily just an open access issue.
Robert, at Stanford, your colleagues, are they generally supportive of open access?
They definitely are supportive of open access. I think they hold the point of view that Jonathan mentioned that, and Peter, that if our tax dollars are paid for the journals, why should we on top of that have to pay for access to read the papers that show the science? So they're very much in favor of open access.
Can we talk some about the traditional peer review system, which a lot of the public thinks is the gold standard? Peter, I know you brought a quote that says something quite differently that we're talking about before the show. Can you share that with us and comment on us?
Yeah, and I'll comment on it, I think, by putting it in context with a political quote as well. So, or it might be a slight misquote, but the sense of it will be there. So this is from Richard Horton. He is editor-in-chief of The Lancet, which is one of the main journals for publishing medical science. And he described peer review as a crude means of discovering the acceptability, not the validity of a new finding. And he went on to say, you know, we know that the system of peer review is biased, unjust, unaccountable, incomplete, easily fixed, often insulting, usually ignorant, occasionally foolish, and frequently wrong. Now, that sounds pretty damning, but I think you have to view that in the light of a quote that I think is from Winston Churchill when asked about democracy, which is when he said words to the effect of, well, it's the worst possible system except for all the alternatives.
Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, I think, I mean, people are maybe thinking that peer review is broken, and I don't think it's that. I think there definitely are problems with it, but I agree with Peter that it's the best we have. I think what's happened is science has become, first of all, it's become more complicated. The data sets are much larger. We're in the age of big data. And it's harder and harder for a reviewer who's working for free, and he also has a full-time job typically as a scientist, right? So he's doing this as volunteer work, to read a paper and to figure out whether it's actually correct or not. It's becoming more and more difficult, and everyone's in a hurry, and the complexity of science is growing. So I think peer review has a role, but I think we have to change the culture of science. What happens now is when a paper gets published, it's sort of set in stone. It's thought, this is correct. And there's a number of cases where a paper has been shown to be completely wrong years later. People continue to cite the original paper because if it's published in Nature or Science, it's truth somehow, people think. But we really have to change the way we think. It's the truth as we knew it at the time. But truth evolves and we learn new things. And I think that's why we have to think of the peer review as an evolving process. It's not just a static thing, but rather it's the idea of post-publication peer review is important. Because the community can learn things about a topic and the truth can evolve.
And that's where your commenting comes
exactly.
in. So we'll come right back to that. But Jonathan, I want to ask you, open access and peer review are not mutually exclusive, right? You can have open access and have some form of peer review. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Absolutely. At PLOS, we do peer review in all of our journals. It's an incredibly important part of how science gets published, partly because of the mixing that happens and why people talk to each other. It's important because the publisher acts as a neutral third party in adjudicating, you know, this is actual valid science, it's written clearly and meets the standards of our journal. But I would push back a little bit on the quote that Peter just read, in that I think it is still the gold standard. I think that even with, the work that I'm doing right now, which is for the last, 6 months plus on alternative systems and evaluation and what we can do next, there isn't any other system that society or humans have that's anywhere close to what peer review does for us in terms of finding out truth in an unbiased way. And yes, it has issues, it has problems, and if we want to, we can dig deeper into that. It's primarily not the science consensus. The science consensus develops later, and it typically develops privately between scientists and people within their lab. It only happens at one time point, and once it's been peer-reviewed, then no one really looks at it again. And it's typically only done by two people, and it's done as free text, and it's done anonymously from the author, and it's typically not shared with the world. So in all of these things, peer review today hasn't maintained pace with all of our advancements with the internet and the communication technologies that we have. PLOS does peer review, and it's incredibly important.
Peter?
To be fair to Richard Horton, whose quote that was, I should say a little bit about the context in which he wrote that. And it was really about the wider public's misperception of what peer review is as much as a comment on any inadequacy of the process. It is, and I use the quote when I'm teaching budding science journalists to make the point that, don't just look at a published paper that's been peer-reviewed and think that equates to this is correct. There are all sorts of reasons why a paper might be incorrect, and peer review isn't necessarily to blame for the underlying flaws of the paper. I should also say there is huge variety in the quality of peer review. If you're at the top few journals, and they make some blunders and publish stuff they shouldn't, or put it another way, they later regret.
Arsenic DNA.
But in general, at that top tier of journals, the standards, the effort that's put into peer review is pretty thorough. But I've reported quite a lot on what you might call the underbelly of science: misconduct, manipulation of images, falsification of data. And when I've been doing that, I've seen some of the papers that have passed peer review, and quite frankly, they make your hair stand on end. I mean, I've looked at a paper and thought that figure cannot possibly be right
now, because
I can see it's been cut and pasted.
Now, because peer review is anonymous, is there any way to go back and see who this slipped by, who actually did the peer review?
For the journal, who know who the peer reviewers were, yes. For me, as a journalist covering it, no. And that really does feed into what I think we're going to go on to discuss, is can we change peer review? Can we introduce commenting that we started talking about? Mm-hmm. And in particular, commenting that isn't anonymous and is in public? And can we augment the existing process of peer review we have with that? And there have been some experiences, which we can talk about. There have been mixed results, but I think that's a really interesting idea.
That's where we're headed. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing whether the Internet is promoting scientific debate or stifling it with our guests, Jonathan Dugan, Director of PLOS Labs and Open Access Science Publisher, Robert Tibshirani, Professor of Statistics and Health Research and Policy at Stanford University, and Peter Aldous, freelance writer and the former San Francisco Bureau Chief of New Scientist magazine. We now invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions or comments. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134, 415-841-4134. You can also email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on KALW.org. Let us know what you think. Is the Internet stifling scientific debate or promoting it? Is peer review flawed? Do you think standards of scientific evaluation could be maintained in the Internet era? Please give us a call or email to join the conversation. Everything, Robert, seems to be headed to what you're doing now in this comment beta at PubMed. Tell us, do you feel a lot of pressure or a lot of people looking at you to kind of solve the dilemmas we're talking about?
Well, first of all, it's not just me. There's a whole team, including Jonathan.
You collectively,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of enthusiasm and for the system. It is an experiment, but it'll rely on the community to really use it and use it properly to succeed.
If I could just jump in.
Please.
Rob's being a little modest here. PubMed Commons is actually really exciting, not just for the comments that it's going to be able to do now, but the team at NCBI at NIH that David Littman leads, has a plan to move this forward. To start with, they're talking about making APIs, so a way in which anyone who puts a comment on a paper on a publisher's website or when they're reading it somewhere else will all funnel into this one central location, and then also APIs the other way, so that any place someone reads a paper, they can see the comments that have been put on that same paper. Comments are one step in the direction of opening up this discussion, and it even goes further than this. Comments could be thought of as one kind of metadata about a paper. So metadata, I mean other kinds of data that people are using with papers. And the same model around comments could be used in lots of other types of metadata about papers. So I see comments as really exciting because it's the next step in taking this internet mentality, this idea that we can be connected, communicating, using APIs to exchange data with each other, and bringing it to a world that is highly conservative, very slow moving, and doesn't really adopt some of these things very quickly. And it's the next step to get us to a place that's far more effective around science publishing.
One of the things I really hope is that this could also improve the quality of science itself, because the way it is now, I mean, suppose I read a paper, and announcing some amazing result, some new thing, and my lab tries to get the same result. I can't get it. I write to the authors, and not much happens. The authors might help me or not. But with PubMed Commons in place, I can go to the website, and I know I learned that 10 other labs are having the same problem I'm having. Mm-hmm. Now, all of a sudden, the onus is on the authors. It's their problem now. Before, it was my problem. Now, it's the author's problem. They have to respond. Their reputation's at stake. So maybe next time they write a paper, they'll be more careful because they'll realize, actually, there's a lot more at stake here. If I do things sloppily or in a hurry or I exaggerate my results, the community is going to find out pretty quickly. Right now, the community doesn't find out until years later, and I'm onto something else. So we want to change the way that science is actually done, slow people down, and try to encourage them to do things, you know, more honestly and of higher quality.
What about the issue we talked about earlier on kind of the journalism sites of people having political agendas and going on and putting comments right. that are really not based in science, that are based on something else entirely?
Right.
How are you going to address that issue?
Well, we're not going to allow those. I mean, the comments are moderated, not to a great extent, but if things are racist or not on topic or inflammatory, we're going to remove them from the site. So we're going to do our best, we being the NIH as well as a group of community group, to moderate the comments and keep keep things constructive.
But as you get bigger and bigger, yeah. isn't it going to be a huge resource strain to keep an eye on all these comments coming in?
That's true. I'm a professor, not a businessman, so maybe I should worry about that more. But yeah.
there's two other things that the PubMed Commons team have pulled together. One is to comment on that system, you have to be identified, right. and you also have to be an author of a paper that is in the PubMed index. So essentially, it is a place for scientists to comment on each other's papers. So I think those two factors involved as well will significantly reduce the problems that were faced by, you know, the journalism community with pseudonymous or fully anonymous commenters.
And you know, the other side benefit I hope to come from this is just the social aspect. As a scientist, one of your greatest fears is you work for years writing a paper, you publish it, and no one reads it, right? Except maybe your best friend who says, you know, But now, you can, with a commenting system, at least you can go there, and even if some of the comments are critical, someone's at least reading your paper. And
right. There's a reaction out there in the real world.
Exactly. And that means a lot to people.
Well, we actually have a caller asking a similar question. Peter from San Francisco, no longer on the line, but his question is, are there examples of famous comments that have impacted science? Is it too early for that, or are there actual examples out there where comments made a big difference in a scientific debate?
Well, they used to be handled differently. They used to be handled as formal letters that were then published by the journals. Off the top of my head, I can't think of ones where I could give an example like that, but there certainly have been examples. But you have to recognize that the whole system we built up for how science worked happened over many hundreds of years, and the Internet's just really catching on in the last 10 or 15. So we don't – I mean, the commenting that we started on PLOS papers in 2006 hasn't had much adoption. That people don't really come to one publisher's. There's, you know, there's 10,000 different science publishers. So there isn't a really high motivation to create an account and make comments on one publisher's website on one, you know, particular paper in the internet way.
Well, there was an example at Duke in the last few years in oncology, looking at drugs for cancer. And through the work of some statisticians from MD Anderson over a number of years, writing letters to the editor, great difficulty. They finally uncovered that the papers were just plain wrong, a whole series of papers. Eventually, they were retracted, and the clinical trials that were started on the basis of the papers were stopped. But it took a huge effort on the part of these scientists to uncover the problems.
You know, Jonathan, you mentioned metadata earlier, and I was wondering if you could explain for our readers, listeners, what you're really talking about when you're talking about metadata in this context.
So there's lots of different kinds of data that we might like to put out with papers. So I'll give you an example. At PLOS, we have a research program called Article Level Metrics, where we collect statistics on who's talking about a particular paper. Where are people tweeting about it? Where are they talking about it on Facebook? Has anyone blogged about this? And we group that together with more traditional metrics like how many people have cited this paper, how many other papers refer back to it. And we bundle that data together, and we publish it on our website with the paper. So when you go and are browsing through the website to see, is this a paper I want to read, I can see some different scores about how much people are talking about it. That could be one example of metadata. One of the projects we're working on in PLOS Labs right now is an alternate system for evaluating papers. So like a review, but much shorter, just a couple minutes and more structured. And we expect that we could get 10 to 50 or, you know, some group of people to do these sort of post-publication evaluations. and the data that comes from them would be another kind of metadata that we would want to publish with a paper. So basically anything about a paper. So you have a data set, for example. You could say that's, if it was a data set used in the paper and you published it with it, that could also be a kind of metadata that goes along with a paper.
You know, I think what Dr. Jonathan is doing is really important. In a way, science is sort of like cable television. There's too many channels and you don't know what to watch, right?
Mm-hmm.
Same in science. We don't know what to read. There's so many, there's an explosion of papers in every area. And to have a filter like peer review, but also some of the things Jonathan talked about, to know what people are reading and what they like, is a filter for scientists to know what to concentrate on is very important.
Now, I could see how citations could be a metric that the scientific community could embrace. Twitter, Facebook, couldn't scientists say, come on now, that's just something that's popular or is a political issue. It really has nothing to do with the quality of the science behind it.
It really depends on which question you're trying to answer. You're right. Number of Twitter discussions doesn't equate to the quality of the science, but it's a first step for where, what is happening with this paper? Are there journalism, you know, articles talking about it? And when you come to Twitter, it actually in the future has a really exciting angle, which is, for the most part, when people start talking about papers, we're going to know who they are. And then you can start to do all sorts of interesting analytics that say, wow, yes, there were only 6 tweets on this, but 4 of them were Nobel laureates. And this is what they're saying about it. And that sort of stuff right now, unless you're actually going and looking to see where the conversation is, that's not even something we can start to look at.
So are you able to look at the quality of the tweeters at this point in your data, or is that something you would look to do in the future?
For the program at PLOS, working on article-level metrics, we're not specifically able to do that yet. But there's broad excitement in the community around collecting metrics around papers. In fact, from our work at PLOS that was sort of seminal in article-level metrics, there have been 3 other companies spawned in this space that are all working to try and produce better analytics and better results for the scientific community.
Peter?
And there's a nice example, actually, from an earlier era of the value of non-traditional metrics, and it involves a period when the New York Times was on strike. Now, it was the printers, I think, who were on strike, not the journalists. So what they were able to do is take a sample of papers from the, I think it was the New England Journal of Medicine, and they knew which ones were covered by the medical journalists but didn't get out to the public, and they were able to match a sample of similar papers when the New York Times was hitting the streets. Lo and behold, when you actually related that to a conventional metric of scientific quality, how much those papers were cited in the scientific literature, the ones that were actually hit the streets in the New York Times had an advantage. So getting covered by journalists means something to the influence of a paper within the narrower community of scientists doing similar work. And I would anticipate that if you did similar studies around Twitter and Facebook, you'd probably be seeing similar things.
We've looked at those data, and yes, there is, not just from PLOS papers, but other folks have used some of our ALM data and shown there is, you know, a bias towards higher citation. It's hard to prove that it came from specific conversations, but we can see a bias.
This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing whether the Internet is promoting scientific debate or stifling it with our guests, Jonathan Dugan, Robert Tibshirani, and Peter Aldous. We invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions and comments. The number to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions917@gmail.com. That's cityvisions917@gmail.com, or post a comment on klw.org. And we're going to go to a call right now. Bill from San Francisco, welcome to City Visions. Bill, are you with us?
Science in the sense that I design medical products and would love to benefit from more information. I frequently go to Google to look up something around patient behaviors, find there's great papers on it, and of course meet paywalls. And you were talking about this democratization. I think it's great, and information, of course, is power in this day and age. And I would wondering whether there is any moves to open up the fact that the public has paid for a lot of this research, yet it's very hard for people like me to benefit from it very easily without going to a lot of trouble.
Bill, thanks for your question. Jonathan.
Yes, that is primarily what the advocacy work of PLOS is working on, is working with both legislators and funders to get this story out to people so that they understand once the public has already paid for science, they really should have access to the results of that science. And we've had some great successes on that in a variety of ways, and there's still a long way to go.
Are you hearing from just average people who are interested in this information rather than just researchers who are interested in it? Because it is interesting to hear callers say, hey, I'm just surfing the internet. I want to get this information, and suddenly I can't access an article. There's the link, but then it says pay this in order to read it. Go ahead.
I can speak to that a little bit because I do some medical journalism, and that includes not only speaking to medical researchers and doctors, but speaking to patients. And when you speak to patients, particularly patients who become part of an activist community, for sure, they want access to the primary research. They don't want it filtered. They want to read it for themselves, and they probably also would like the opportunity to comment on it. So I definitely encounter that from people in the wider community.
What about you, Jonathan? Are you mainly speaking with other scientists, or is the general public starting to get wind of what you're doing?
I think the general public is getting wind of it. I think shows like this can help have people see that mm-hmm. this is actually a huge debate that's going on. There's a few points here. The traditional publishers are far, far larger and far more powerful than the open access publishers. They've been around for a lot longer. They have a lot more momentum, and they get a lot more money for the business that they run. And it's happening with a political debate, in legislatures. But it doesn't make any sense. It makes no sense the way the existing system works. And the public should be up in arms. They should say, why don't we have access to this? We've already paid for it.
Why did it survive this way for so long?
The premise of open access makes a lot more sense in the internet age. So when you go to the work of actually printing a piece of paper, there was real work there. And it made sense for businesses to keep track of copyright and access issues in a different age. Today, with digital publishing and the ease it takes to get information out and the ease with which we can communicate, it makes a lot more sense.
How have things changed with the speed at which you can finish a paper and actually see it out there in the world versus needing to print it up and it comes out months later? And then to have these comments, Robert, be instantaneous. How does that change things? How does that change the dynamic of scientific debate?
Well, it certainly changes the pace. It accelerates the pace greatly. And I think the quality may suffer as a result because people are in such a hurry. They're in a race with the next lab to get this next hot result out. And as a result, they cut corners often, and the quality suffers.
So the pace has gotten better with internet communication in terms of how fast we can publish things, but speed and efficiency are two areas that PLOS is actually working on a lot to try and get papers out faster. If you look at the amount of time it takes for someone to go from their research is done to it's in a published journal and then everyone else can see it, typically that time now is about 6 months. And that's a huge average over lots of factors. Many people submit to multiple different journals, get rejected at maybe more prestigious ones, and then resubmit. So a typical journal processing time from submission to publication is maybe 4 months. But we would like to see that time from done work to published be as absolutely short as possible. We'd like to see that be a week if we could get there, because that will greatly accelerate our ability to do science and aggregate knowledge.
Peter.
And I think another thing to bear in mind is the huge variation from field to field in science that feeds into this question of pace and quality, and also the extent to which the sort of things we're talking about, opening up peer review, having online comments be part of that process maybe, are going to be very different how it plays out in different fields. And we're already seeing this. So one where I think we already know that it's going to be a hard sell is molecular and cellular biology. Now, if you have a well-funded lab in that field, essentially, if you hear about somebody's experiment and know how it's done, you can repeat it very, very quickly. You can bang it out to one of the top journals. And the Times, Jonathan gave, are absolutely right, but on occasions they can push stuff out in days, which means there's a real worry in those fields about people being scooped. Mm-hmm. Now, if what you're doing is searching for the Higgs boson with the one experiment in the world that can do it and a huge piece of equipment that costs countless billions and there are thousands and thousands of people involved, it's a very different dynamic. So those fields are completely different in their dynamics of publication, and they're completely different in their attitudes to whether the published paper is the important thing, whether they'll put out early versions, sometimes called preprints, on the internet, the extent to which they're open to the idea of having sort of online comment on those preprints being part of the peer review process. And there are some cases where that's happening that we can talk about if you want. It's going to vary a lot. Some fields are going to embrace it. Physicists are likely to embrace it. I think we're already seeing that those scientists working in sort of earth and atmospheric sciences are largely embracing it. Certain other areas, particularly in very competitive areas of biology and medicine, I think less so. And that's going to be a harder sell and maybe a particular issue for PubMed.
Have you found that, Robert, that different areas of science are reacting to this differently?
Well, most of my contact has been in the biomedical area, which mm-hmm. is what PubMed indexes. So I haven't really talked to scientists in other areas to find out.
Let's go to an email from Carl in San Francisco, who asks, could there be a curated group of responders? Isn't that kind of what PubMed is? If you need to have published, if you need to be verified before you can comment on the site as of now?
Yes. So in order to comment, you have to be a PubMed author. You've published a paper that's indexed by PubMed, and you have to be verified to be that person. So that's what we have in place now.
We have a few moments left, and I want to bring up this Science Magazine piece that I know you all have been hearing a lot about, and I thought maybe, Peter, you could give us a quick overview of this experiment that was done by a Science Magazine reporter submitting a fake paper, and kind of what happened and what the fallout from that has been.
So basically what happened, journalists working for Science Magazine produced a fake paper with a lot of obvious flaws. It was about allegedly anti-cancer properties of a compound isolated from lichens. Submitted it to a whole bunch of journals, 300 or so, and about half of them accepted it. So that says some interesting things about how good peer review is. A lot of variability, clearly. The fatal flaw is that he only submitted it to open access journals, and it was framed really as a criticism or a commentary. I won't say criticism, a commentary on standards of peer review in open access. Well, of course, any scientist will look at that and say, well, where was the control experiment? Why didn't you submit it to a similar sample of traditional journals? Then we can see how peer review works in open access as opposed to traditional journals. But unfortunately, that wasn't done.
How hard was it for PLOS when this came out? And of course, PLOS is one of the folks who got it right, who rejected this article. But what has the fallout been for you from this?
There's been a tremendous amount of discussion. I want to mirror and sort of elaborate on some of the things Peter said. Not only did he submit it only to open access journals, but he specifically used a list of the known bad actors in the open access community as one of his sources of which journals to submit it to. So it wasn't necessarily even a statistically correct sampling.
That's the kind of bad science we want to...
Right, and actually this was a list. Someone keeps a list of these, quote, bad journals, and he just wrote to everyone on that list. Yes, right.
So the reaction within the science community has been loud and quite negative on this as a practice. Plus came through looking extremely good. In fact, it's quite telling if people are interested in this. The journalist who did this for Science actually published all of the email chains that he had with the publishers. And if you go back and you look at what...
Metadata, by the way.
Which could be metadata, yeah. Yes. Although typically with these, we wouldn't want to put that metadata with these. But in this case, yes, this is metadata. And if you look through the discussion channel, it was actually our ethics check that the authors in submitting this fake paper couldn't justify where they got their cell lines from, and that the animals that were used to create these new cell lines were done in an ethical were used in an ethical manner. And it was so painfully obvious that he didn't have the right question, you know, the answers to these questions in the email exchange, because he was just making it all up. That it was quickly, after we sent it to some reviewers, it was quickly rejected with just single lines, no, this doesn't meet what we're looking for. And the other thing to add about this particular topic is that Science magazine is one of the leading traditional publishers. So they are an example of one of these publishers that keeps the copyright on articles submitted to them, or keeps control of the articles and sells access to it. And they make a lot more money than most any other journal, and have a lot to lose by open access succeeding in all the ways that it is.
So what was the reason giving for not having a control group? How could Science magazine not have a control group here?
So I should declare I've worked at Science on the news side in the past, so I have a lot of affection for it. I can't speak to that. The best reason I've seen given in from the journalists involved was lack of time. I don't really buy that as a valid explanation, put it that way. I mean, certainly as a journalist, I know all about having limitations of time. I'm just very surprised, because I think it hurts Science that its news editors didn't just demand that right from the word go when the story was pitched to them. That sounds really interesting, but there are certain, if we're going to do that, we want to make this about Science publishing, not about open access publishing. And then if it had been conducted in a more methodologically defensible way, and one or other types of the published, you know, one or other model seemed to be superior, then we'd have something interesting to talk about. But unfortunately at the moment, it's very difficult to know what to make of that article.
They should have hired a statistician on that study. That was the problem.
Another interesting thing is that they had a press release that was very inflammatory, more inflammatory than the paper itself, which is kind of like an inflammatory comment, right? It isn't even the paper itself, but whoever approved that press release made some strong claims that were stronger, as I understand it, than the actual article in Science actually said.
On the other end of the spectrum, to my delight, I saw a comment on PubMed Commons this week. An author criticized his own paper. He said, I published this paper 3 years ago, and it was all wrong. He said, I'm sorry.
Tell me more about that. That's so interesting.
Well, he just said, at the time we thought it was right, but in retrospect it was wrong. And then a few years later, we did it the right way. But this first paper was just wrong. And he just says this right in press.
Had anyone commented to point out what was wrong, or he just himself said, I've just realized this was wrong and I want to correct this for the
himself.
Record?
He just wanted to confess.
So what's next for PubMed?
Well, we want to expand. Well, our next move is right now you have to be in the system to comment or read comments. But we want to move to a situation where you don't have to be even in the system to read comments. So just going to PubMed, you can go to PubMed and see the comments. So you'll be able to read comments and papers if they're open access. And then to expand the system and add more features and just try to get some momentum among the community.
Speaking of momentum, PLOS seems to have a tremendous amount of momentum. What's coming up for PLOS?
PLOS continues to grow. We're hiring a bunch of people. Our year-over-year growth in submissions and journal publication is about 40% per year. We continue to advocate strongly for open access and push for innovation in science communication. I mean, originally, it was our open access policy that was innovative and new that we pushed forward with. We created this journal PLOS One, which through an editorial change accepts science from all different disciplines, just if it's good science, not if it's, you know, important enough. And we continue to push forward on ALMs. In the last 6 months, we opened up PLOS Labs, which is specifically intended to design, develop, and test new product prototypes. And our next thing we're working on is a completely novel system for peer evaluation. So unlike peer review, where there's this deep dive by two people, we're looking at an online system that takes into account a lot of the tools and technology we know from the internet so that peers can evaluate each other in a structured way.
And Peter, quickly, as a freelance journalist, what do you see yourself covering in the year to come on this issue?
Well, I'm now doing most of my work for two organizations, Medium, which is a new writing platform, and Matter, which is a forum for long-form journalism. I'm pretty confident that the issues we've been talking about here will be right in the center of what I'm covering over the coming years.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for joining us. That's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Jonathan Dugan, Robert Tibshirini, and Peter Aldous. Thank you all for joining me this evening. This is David Onick. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great week.
Thank you, David. You're listening to 91.7 KALW San Francisco. We are your local public radio station. It is 8 o'clock and time for As It Happens.
Hi there, I'm Carol Off.
And I'm Jeff Douglas, coming up on As It Happens.
A year-long investigation by a South African university leads to claims of prisoner abuse at the country's Mangaung Correctional Center. The researcher who led the investigation says video shot within the prison's walls shows inmates being tortured by employees of the British-based security firm G4S.
And despite inspiring revolutionaries in the former Czechoslovakia, as well as musical giants like David Bowie, Lou Reed only had one top 40 hit, Walk on the Wild Side. We're going to hear from the man who stood behind the man on that song, bassist Herbie Flowers.
Those stories and many more are coming up on the Monday edition of As It Happens.